From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A thunderclap yesterday at the University of Missouri. The president resigning, the chancellor stepping down. The university's leadership accused of ignoring racist, bigoted incidents on campus. And weeks of escalating student protests. A ticket to a top school, university, might be seen as a ticket out of America's racial tensions. This week, students in Missouri and beyond saying, no, it's not, and calling for change. In some quarters, that call is running into warnings over free speech and academic freedom. This hour on Point, race on campus at Missouri and beyond. A little sound here from yesterday. The press conference, University of Missouri, President Tim Wolf resigning. Said the campus unrest was rooted in lack of communication. Said the fault lies with him.
We have to respect each other enough to stop yelling at each other and start listening. And quit intimidating each other. And I take full responsibility for this frustration, and I take full responsibility for the inaction that has occurred.
And he's gone. Joining me now from Columbia, Missouri, home of the University of Missouri's flagship campus, is Elizabeth Lutfi. She's a junior at the university and editor-in-chief of The Maneater, the university's independent student newspaper. Elizabeth Lutfi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Columbia in Missouri is University of Missouri junior and student activist there, Naomi Collier. Naomi, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Naomi, you have been, I assume, out in the courtyards and quads and maybe even streets as part of the protests that have been going on. What do you see at the heart of the tension that's mounted in these weeks and months?
I would say personally, from the heart, at the heart of all the inaction is probably just people fail to realize that you have to be empathetic. We have been out for months now, and I would dare even say a year, trying to get the attention of the university, trying to educate individuals on the different issues that we have on campus, and no one has been listening. And, you know, like a small child, when you don't feel like your parents are listening to you, you act out. And so we had to essentially do what we thought would get attention, would stir up the University of Missouri and would get the faculty and the university administration and obviously the nation to look at us so that they can see that this is not a small problem. We are the next, you know, generation that's going to go out to our workforce, and that these are the values that we carry into our workforce, that we're just only going to perpetuate discrimination in the workplace.
Naomi, do you feel, have you felt a palpable atmosphere of racism at the campus? We've heard, we've seen the reports that you know of the president of the student body being called the N-word, shouted at him, of other black students the same when they're practicing to put on a skit on campus. That makes it sound pretty vivid.
Definitely. Actually, I was one of those students out there practicing the play, and you know, That happened to me personally. I saw what it was like for a white individual to feel audacious enough to approach us minding our own business and call us out of our names. I know what it's like to see the safety officer on duty not react in the way that we felt that she should have. So these are instances that I can personally say that I went through that. And other people that I'm very close to have gone through very similar situations, whether it's being called out of their name, just people being insensitive to issues that are directly affecting us as people, or whether it's just pure ignorance. A lot of people do and say things just out of ignorance and just not knowing. And so these are things that we face on a daily basis. And again, I attribute that to just a lack of empathy and a lack of willing to be educated and understand the struggles that other groups go through on a daily basis, especially marginalized groups.
Here was the University of Missouri graduate student Jonathan Butler, who went on hunger strike for days here, week-long hunger strike, finally ended with the resignation of the school's president yesterday, talking with ABC's Good Morning America today, describing what he sees as a racially charged environment on campus.
The campus climate here at the University of Missouri has been unlivable since I was here as an undergraduate student. So I started here at the university in 2008. And in my first semester here, I had individuals write the N-word on my wall. I had white students who were literally physically assaulting me. The campus culture here is just not welcoming to people who aren't of the majority identity.
Elizabeth Lutfi, you're editing the newspaper there. What do you see as the element or elements that finally brought the president to decide he was out of there, resigning?
I would say, you know, these student movements have been gaining momentum ever since last year with the shooting and killing of of Mike Brown. Ever since there have been student demonstrations on campus. And so I think, and it's taken this whole year until everything kind of like hit. And I think a lot of the fact that, you know, the football team announced their demonstrations, and I think like the fact that it hit national media, I think everything just kind of exploded at the same time. And I think like from a student journalist perspective, covering it has just been really, really crazy. Everyone has been like all hands on deck.
You must talk with a lot of students there of many races and ethnicities and backgrounds. Is there a consensus now, Elizabeth? Are people saying, we get it, we understand the complaint of African-American students on the campus? What are they, about 8% of the campus? Are people saying, yes, we understand this needs to change, or is there resistance to that?
That's really, really hard to gauge, especially on a campus of 36,000 undergraduates and graduate students. I would say from my understanding, the most vocal students have been very, very supportive of student groups such as Concerned Student 1950. However, there have been some students who have responded negatively to the movements, but those have also been on social media grounds such as like Yik Yak, which is an anonymous ground. So I think the people who have been like speaking out negatively have really been like taking to social media more than anything else.
I want to get at this issue of how people perceive what's going on. You're editor in chief of the student newspaper there. If I had come to you 6 months ago and said, "Are you editor in chief of a paper at a racist campus, or where there is an intolerable threat or stream or volume of racism," what would you have said?
6 months ago?
Yeah.
I would say yes. We are in Missouri, the state of Missouri. Our institution is deeply rooted in exclusion from different like minority groups. The first black student wasn't allowed on campus until 1950.
Naomi, how big an influence has Ferguson had? Elizabeth mentioned, of course, Mike Brown, and that is, what, 100 miles or so east of where you are now. Were students on the campus involved in the demonstrations in Ferguson in the weeks and months after the killing of Mike Brown there? Is that Black Lives Matter and more sort of movement part of what we're seeing played out in Columbia now?
Most definitely. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, actually. A lot of my family lives in the Ferguson, Florida area. A lot of my cousins went to Ferguson, Florida district schools. And so this, at least for me personally, and I know a lot of other students that are from the St. Louis area, was very, very impactful for them, because Mike Brown wasn't the first Mike Brown, in my opinion. You know, there have been plenty of situations prior to Mike Brown in the St. Louis area, in the St. Louis County area, that just did not blow up and get the same amount of press as Mike Brown did. So for that to get national coverage the way that it did, I do believe that that was part of the catalyst that led into what we're experiencing now. And even, you know, last year, that a lot of that activism was happening then, and that was really the first time that I had ever seen non-traditional organizations on campus kind of formulate to be able to act, protest or demonstrate for those different causes, especially Mike Brown. And so that obviously led into this year, because we've had, you know, hundreds of other Mike Browns since then, and you can only do so much to a person's psyche, and they not, you know, at least try to resist that or let them know how they truly feel about that. The Mike Brown incident, he was supposed to be a college student. That's another, you know, pointer for us. You know, he could have easily been in the same area as us, but due to his race, due to him being discriminated against, he wasn't able to live to his live up to his potential like we are. And so we take it very seriously. We take that responsibility to you know, live for him and fight for him. You know, and any other Black life that we have lost due to an injustice across the nation, we do our best to ensure that, you know, we don't allow things that we can change to continue to be perpetuated, especially at the university level. The state of Missouri has a responsibility to us to educate us properly. This is what our parents have paid for. This is what taxes have paid for. This, all these things have been allotted and you know, taken for. And myself and other students, there's no way that we can allow things like this to happen, especially given, you know, our backgrounds, our hometowns, the situations that have happened there, and not step out and be able to, you know, come together and fight for what we need and fight for what we deserve.
Naomi, do you think the football team threatening not to play in this weekend's game against Brigham Young, that would have been a $1 million penalty for the University of Missouri, did that make the difference? Was that the straw that broke the camel's back here?
Most definitely. I find it funny because, you know, we have written letters, we have sat in meetings, everybody has done something, you know, small leading up to this in their own way. There have been protests, there have been digital demonstrations, we've marched, we've done sit-ins, we've done all these different forms of, you know, peaceful protest activism, and none of it has been taken seriously. I think that...
Naomi Collar, hold it right there if you'd be good enough, and Elizabeth Lutfi, stick with me for just a minute here. A couple of calls for you, and we'll go to Kevin Blackstone and Sean Harper. We're looking at race and race issues front and center on campus. Listeners, you can join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about race and race issues front and center on campus, the upheaval at the University of Missouri and beyond, a president out, a chancellor stepped down, a football team threatened strike there, a hunger strike now ended. Kevin Blackstone and Sean Harper join us in just a moment, but we've got calls for the two of you, and I want to put some of them to you from Columbia, Missouri. Debbie is calling. Debbie, very good to have you. Thank you for calling. What do you see?
Thank you. I am amazed at what the students did. However, there is a long history of racism at the university. It's institutionalized, and it's curious to me why the possible death of a student did not cause the administration to have any action. Rather, it was the potential loss of $1 million.
Mm-hmm. You mean the student Jonathan Butler, who was threatening to stay on hunger strike until he died, if necessary?
That's correct. The last time the university had students camping out on the quadrangle was the apartheid movement. The only thing that got that going again was money.
Are you surprised, Debbie, at this? I mean, when the football team makes a threat like that, that is a lot of money. Are you surprised that that's what it took?
I'm not surprised at all. I'm also very saddened because it tells me that the university doesn't want to address racism. They want to collect their money at the cost of the student athletes who some have argued are acting in slavery.
Debbie, I appreciate your call from Columbia, Missouri. Elizabeth Lutfi, I'm looking here at a photograph from Homecoming, where some Black students blocked the car of the university president, Tim Wolf, with their complaints about racism on campus. And President Wolf, from the shots I can see here, just kind of sits in the back of the convertible, you know, up on the top of the back seat like you do in parades, and seems to almost ignore these students around him, with Black students with linked arms. I mean, was he just out of his depth here? He was a corporate guy brought in, I think, to cut costs in the university system. What I see in this photograph doesn't look like a guy who's very nimble in responding, Elizabeth.
Yep. Tim Wolf has been at MU only for a couple of years. Those students were some of the original members of Concerned Student 1950, who have been really leading this entire movement. And, yeah, I mean, in his statement, which was, in my opinion, long overdue from that incident, he said he was caught off guard and didn't really know what to do and regretted his reaction to the situation.
These days, you have got to be very alert to what's going on around you if you want to lead in positions where you've got so much social flux as we see in this country. Taylor in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Taylor, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. A couple comments. As an African American, I do disagree with your two guests. I don't view Michael Brown as a martyr. just a reminder that the Federal Department of Justice did find that there was no criminal activity by the police officer, and actually it was justifiable use of lethal force. And I would caution them about the mob mentality at the college in terms of trying to institute change. While they certainly have a right to protest, what happened to the right to due process for the president and the chancellor? So while they're frustrated, and I can understand that to a certain point, how they go about that change should be of concern to them. I mean, if you look online at some of the protests, it was actually a college professor of mass media that was calling for muscle to remove members of the media. I mean, the absurdity of that is just striking.
Yeah, that one baffles me. On the other hand, Taylor, you say due process, but these weren't legal charges. These were questions that go to leadership, where the student body president, African-American, was being called the N-word, and you had all these other incidents, and the campus president didn't seem capable or prepared to respond. Isn't that an issue?
Well, it is, but what do we know about those incidents? And that's where the due process and discovery, even though it's not a criminal matter in terms of their leadership, that would come about. Was that an outsider? Was it a Missouri student? Was it somebody pretending to be a Missouri student? We don't know. So while they got what they wanted in terms of getting the president out of there, in the big picture, what is it going to do?
Let me hold that question, Taylor, and get one more call here, and I'll take it to Naomi Collier and Elizabeth. Greg in Nashville, you're on.
Hey, hi, Tom, and hello to your guests. Much like your last caller, well, I am in strong support of with the activism and the call to actions of these students. I'm a little bit perturbed and almost uncomfortable with the language and the rhetoric. When you ask, when your first point is to ask somebody to essentially apologize for who they are, and it was to ask Tom Wolf to apologize, admit and apologize for his white privilege, at that point, you are making enemies out of what are potentially friends and combatants in this struggle. Because when you ask someone to essentially, if I ask you, Tom, to apologize for who you are, essentially, something that you could never change, then what recourse do you have from that point on?
But Greg, what if they were asking him to apologize for a failure in leadership? I mean,
His last caller just went to what is the specific failure of leadership that he didn't? I mean, she almost articulated they didn't respond in the way that we felt he should have, and that's very relative and that's subjective, and that's no if I tell you I'm not sure that you responded in the way that I felt you should respond, mm-hmm. that gets into a very gray, very murky area, and I can't really get behind that. There needs to be something concrete and something that is definitive there.
Greg, let me put it to Naomi while I've got her, and I appreciate your call. Naomi Collier, how about it? Here, not concrete enough, the complaints and a kind of concern over mob mentality, lack of due process. What do you say, Naomi?
Right. To the previous two callers, you are misinformed. There have been several, myself included, attempts to reach the university officials, reach the president, reach all of these people who have power and authority within the system that I have paid to be a student and citizen in. With that said, there have been statements, there have been meetings, there have been sit-downs, there have been town halls, there have been all these different forms of, if that's what you want to call, due process. In order to come to a mutual understanding, this is what we are going through as students of color at the University of Missouri. This is what we have to deal with. If you are a leader, you are most definitely concerned with the day-to-day lifestyle of your students. It's just that simple. It's not a matter of, he did not respond the way that we wanted him to. He did not respond as a leader. That is what the issue was. He did not respond as a leader. He did not respond as an educator. As an educator, there's no way that you are going to allow a marginalized student to continue to be marginalized in a place where they're trying to get an education. The entire purpose of us coming to this university was to come and gain our degree in an interest area so that we are able to enter into the world and the workforce and the line that we paid for. Okay. So with that said, again, I can see where the two gentlemen prior
may have things confused, but it's just that it's confusion because there's plenty of research. And if Taylor and I'm not sure the gentleman Greg, if you guys would like me to email you all of the steps that have been taken prior to the hunger strike and prior to the boycott and prior to Tim Wolf's removal from office, I will be more than happy to do that. If you give us your email, I can send you that immediately. But there has been so much more than just what you guys have seen. To the mob mentality issue, I would, again, strongly disagree with that. It wasn't necessarily mob mentality, but there are strength in numbers. In order for an institution like this to move, it has to be a large movement. So if you consider that a mob, you're more than welcome to do so. But in my opinion, and in the opinion of my brothers and sisters who are out there with me, who have been out there for days on the quad and throughout the different dining halls and marching on campus and walking into these different facilities on campus, informing people, educating people on what we have to go through as students and citizens of this university, then, you know, I'm not sure how else to explain that to you. There's strength in numbers. It's not mob mentality.
Naomi Collier and Elizabeth Lutfi, juniors at the University of Missouri, joining us today from Columbia, Missouri. Elizabeth, editor-in-chief of The Maneater, the student newspaper there, and Naomi, who's been very active in all of this. Our thanks to you both. Naomi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Lutfi, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Here, just this morning on Morning Edition, NPR Howard Bryant, ESPN reporter, talked about what's changing here, especially when you come to the athletes and their sort of major contribution to what happened with the president and chancellor out. Here he is talking about this generation of student-athletes.
They are children of Ferguson. They are children of Eric Garner. They are children of the Black Lives Matter movement. They are very different from as me being a child of the 80s, very different from remembering Michael Jordan in the 80s and 90s as the athletes that would not get involved, that sort of stayed behind the glass of their luxury cars. These young men now take a responsibility. They are citizens, and they're using their influence in a way that we really haven't seen from athletes since the 1960s.
I want to dive on into this situation at the University of Missouri and beyond. Kevin Blackstone joins us now, sports columnist at the Washington Post, visiting professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland, panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. Kevin Blackstone, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Philadelphia, Sean Harper joins us, executive director of the Center for the Study of Race and Equity in Education at the University of Pennsylvania, associate professor there of higher education at the UPenn Graduate School of Education. Sean Harper, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Kevin, first to you and this team where at least a bunch of Black members, and they seem to have a lot of support or a fair amount of support from white members as well, and the coach, stepped up and played something like a critical role in this standoff at the University of Missouri. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised in the context of Missouri, because as your guest pointed out earlier, what roiled into this campus really began with the Michael Brown incident in Ferguson. And there were actually protests at the University of Missouri in Columbia around what happened in Ferguson. So a lot of kids at the University of Missouri were already politicized. But for the players to step up and to add weight to Jonathan Butler's protest was obviously significant, and it was also disturbing. As your guest, as one of your callers pointed out, and it's something I'm writing about right now, that you know, the university would value a football game against BYU this weekend and the fact that it would have to pay a penalty of $1 million or more if it could not play that game over Jonathan Butler's life, which he laid down for remedies that he sought from that university's administration, not just for himself, but for other people of color at the university. And that's really what's disturbing, but it also underscores the importance of the BLM, Black Lives Matter movement. We have to continue to remind people that our lives do matter.
Sean Harper, how do you see what's just happened at the University of Missouri and put it in the context of race issues being front and center and very hot lately on other campuses around the country, at Yale, at UCLA, University of Michigan, Oklahoma, Arizona State? What's going on, Sean?
Researchers in my center and I
spend time on dozens of campuses each year assessing the racial climate. And unfortunately, what has happened at University of Missouri happens at hundreds, perhaps even thousands of predominantly white college and university
but
campuses
what is it?
Like it across the country,
mm-hmm.
where we hear students of color, and in our work, we also do research on faculty and staff of color sharing deeply painful reports and experiences of encounters with racism, being called the N-word and other racial slurs, being tragically underrepresented in just about every class they enter or every office and department in which they work. And, you know, we hear these painful stories and reflections on and really like impassioned reports of frustration that no one seems to care about us here. And we are constantly sharing our experiences, making our realities known to the university administration. But yet, you know, our complaints seem to fall on deaf ears, we often hear in our research. So in many ways, I am, you know, really inspired that Jonathan Butler took on the leadership of, you know, really sort of bringing more consciousness to the experiences of students of color there at University of Missouri. And I'm absolutely delighted that the members of the football team chose to flex their collective muscle to get this done.
Kevin Blackstone, you spent some time at University of Missouri as a fellow back in the 1980s.
Right.
You know something about a campus from your work right now. I mean, when the head of the student body there, a young black man, is taunted with the N-word on campus, that's not subtle. When black students rehearsing for a dramatic performance are taunted with that by a white student, that's not subtle. But when some people hear no one seems to care about us here, for students who are in university, they seem to be, to some extent, privileged by that simple fact, people may say, what do you mean they don't care about you? What does that mean, Kevin?
Well, I mean, I think people want, you know, at one point they want dignity. They just want to be respected. And I think that my reading of this story and knowing that the Columbia campus is a very isolated place in Missouri. And, you know, Missouri has a very interesting history in this country when you talk about race and law.
All the way back to Civil War days and before.
Sure, and you look at the Dred Scott case, mm-hmm. and it's a very isolated place. And the percentages of black students there is relatively small. And one thing I should point out, because Sean Harper, along with his colleagues Colin Williams and Horatio Blackman, have done some excellent research on the place of black athletes on campuses and what they really stand for and what it really means. And so it's a very small community. And I think that people felt as if they were being ignored, that no one was paying attention. And you heard in, I think it was Naomi's voice, talking about the fact that no one was taking them seriously. And so they finally had to act out. And it's a very, you know, a college campus can be a very lonely place for minority students. And they didn't feel as if their problems were being addressed. And it's difficult on many campuses. The University of Maryland, where I teach,
mm-hmm.
it's slightly different because of the relationship to Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and these large populations of black people. But in a place like Columbia, Missouri, significantly different.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. That sound very much from the year 2015. Yesterday, after the announcement that Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri system, had stepped down, resigned, students at the campus in Columbia broke into song in the midst of the announcement there. What do you see going on here? Is free speech a primary virtue here? Can it be a cover for racism? Have you assumed that when kids go to college, they're moving into a zone beyond these problems? is anywhere in this country beyond these problems? We'll hear a voice from Yale University in a moment. Lots of listeners writing into us here. Gina says on Facebook, if the student body and faculty don't have confidence in his leadership, Tim Wolf's, there's no way he can govern effectively. And certainly that seemed to come in to question here. All kinds of reaction. Ryan says racism is pervasive on university campuses because most institutions were founded by and for white majorities and perpetuate their power. Getting into some kind of deep analysis there. Supreme Gentleman says, back when I was in school, if someone offended you, you would reply with an expletive and leave it at that. But call for systematic change is more in the air here. James says, it seems like there should be a middle ground between safe zones and censorship and not doing anything when your students are called the N-word from people in pickup trucks. You know, Sean, there's been pushback as well here from conservative quarters. The Wall Street Journal talking about Yale's little Robespierre, saying they're trying to close down academic discourse there. The Atlantic talking about a new tolerance of student activism. Connor Friedersdorf writing in The Atlantic. And here, I mean, this is from the Manhattan Institute, conservative outfit in New York. Let me just put this to you. Heather McDonald writes, the pathological narcissism of American college students has found a potentially devastating new source of power in the sports industrial complex. Is this, Sean Harper, about pathological narcissism?
I don't think so. If we listen carefully to what Naomi said, mm-hmm. she was calling for empathy, for university leaders, faculty, and others to be empathetic of the experiential realities of people of color on a predominantly white campus. I would like to take it a step further and say that the students are also asking for their campuses to be responsive. There's so much evidence in the research community and in, you know, the daily reports of, you know, people's encounters with racism on campuses that simply get ignored. That evidence gets ignored. It tends to fall on deaf ears. It doesn't engender either empathy nor a serious institutional response. At best, you know, people get window dressing, or they get, you know, some sort of compensatory response where, you know, there's an effort to help students of color become more resilient. There was a march on resilience at Yale, for example.
What does that mean, a march on resilience? What does that mean?
It means that, you know, so much effort is often placed on helping Black and Latino students especially figure out ways to resist the racism that they experience in classrooms and elsewhere. So lots of attention is placed on, you know, giving them defensive protective strategies. My stance on that is that those strategies would not be necessary if there was not racism, you know, waiting for them on the other side of the classroom door.
What kind of racism in the classroom? I mean, people may scratch their heads and think, wait, you know, when George Wallace stood in the, you know, in the door of the school and said, you're not coming in here, we get it. That's racism when he says that to Black students. When they're enrolled and they're in class and they're studying alongside students of other races, how does racism come in? Explain it, Sean.
Several examples that we often hear in our research are whenever, you know, there is some discussion about the ghetto or about poverty, people immediately turn to the person of color to be the expert and the spokesperson for that experience. Even if the person of color did not come from, you know, an urban low-income place. That's one example. Another is students of color being repeatedly passed over for, you know, memberships in student study groups and so on. Like, nobody wants to work with the Latino kid because there's a presumption that she isn't a well-prepared student. There's also, you know, whenever there's some racial tension perhaps that might come up in the readings, professors oftentimes, you know, take a hands-off approach and students of color are left there to fend for themselves without any support or intervention from the professor. Those are just three of hundreds of examples that we, again, repeatedly hear in our research with students of color.
Kevin, you know, to some ears, those will sound pretty subtle. Do those sound like heinous racial offenses to you, or is this all the part of the process of, I mean, given where we started with African Americans in chains, in slavery, is this still part of sort of ironing out the remaining wrinkles, or is that like just too subtle to take to the streets over?
No, we're still breaking from those shackles, Tom, and I think Sean hit on it. You know, I know that when the University of Maryland goes through the accreditation process and they send around question and answer sheets to people on the faculty, you know, one of the things they want to know is how diverse is your approach to teaching. So what they mean by that is knowing that there are just a few faculty of color on college campuses. They want to know from everyone, when you bring in guest speakers, are you conscious of bringing in people of color who may have a different point of view on what you're teaching? When you're providing readings, are you conscious of being diverse with those authors so that people can see a different point of view? All those things really kind of add up. Those are the subtle things that that can be of concern sometimes. So those are the kinds of things I think you have to look out on for the college campus when you talk about diversity and making sure you're meeting the demands, not only of students of color, but also from students who come into a college campus and for the first time really may have one black teacher or may be sitting in a classroom that is a third of color and not just in an all-white high school, which still exists in this country.
Let's turn to look at another school. Yale has had its own issues over the last couple of weeks. Last Friday, WTNH in New Haven talked with a couple of students of color there, Nicole Nelson, Edward Dong, about how they want to change the atmosphere at Yale.
Endgame would be having a greater commitment to diversity.
Our place on this campus is like a marginalized one. You know, it's like we leave campus in order to do like our cultural activities, in order to really, find spaces where we can be who we are.
Let's turn to New Haven, Connecticut, and Alejandra Padin Dujon. She is a sophomore at Yale, part of the Yale Black Women's Coalition. She's involved with the African American Cultural Center and La Casa, the Latino Cultural Center at Yale, from Portland, Oregon, originally. Alejandra, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So I'm looking here at numbers from Yale based on the 2014 enrollment, and it says 42% of the students at Yale consider themselves minority, 9% black, 9% Hispanic, 20% Asian, 2% Native American. With 42%, you know, self-identifying as minority, it may strike some people as hard to understand how race and racism can still be an issue when the proportion is that high.
What's important to understand is that despite the fact that a significant portion of the student population at Yale does self-identify as minority, the power structures that are woven into the way we receive our education and the way student life functions and the kind of access we have to mental health services consistently marginalizes us. That just shows how pervasive these forces are that they can marginalize such a massive portion of the student population.
Can you describe what happened in the last couple of weeks that got people so up in arms?
In the last couple of weeks, there have been a few incidents on campus that have really ignited the racial tensions and the feeling that this university is profoundly racist. These have included an incident at the banned fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon in which it's alleged that fraternity brothers turned away black women and women of color of other backgrounds by saying that it was a white girls only space.
They deny that, but apparently that people are reporting that's what they said at the door.
Yes, okay. And I truly believe it.
Okay.
And in addition to that, there was a highly controversial email about cultural appropriation that was sent out by the associate master, Erica Christakis of Silliman College, which is one of our residential colleges, roughly speaking a dorm, in response to a previous email sent out by the Intercultural Affairs Committee. Essentially, the original email was encouraging students to be conscientious, encouraging them to make moral and sensitive decisions. And the response from Erica Christakis was to say that even considering the perspectives of minority students on campus was, in effect, limiting free speech.
So the university was suggesting don't dress up in blackface or feather headdresses like Indian headdress or turban, culturally offensive ways. The faculty member there said, what about free speech? And that really got people upset.
Well, that's one way of putting it. I really want to steer the conversation away from ideas of hurt feelings and offense, because the fact is, for example, if a white person says the N-word in a room completely full of white people, it's still wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're dealing with here is a profound moral wrongness and moral error that's more about the extent to which individual white students or privileged students identify with oppressors and with oppressive systems than it's about minority students being overly sensitive.
Alejandra, what do you say to people who might say, Alejandra, and look, I say this with affection. My own daughter is there in the middle of all this. I was there years ago. But who might say, you're at such an elite institution, what do you have to complain about? You're at the top of the American education pyramid, or right up there.
What's important to note is that although we are at the top of the educational pyramid in the United States, the forces of racism are still present here, and I think it's extremely concerning for the United States and race relations as a whole that even in intellectual spaces that are supposed to be conscious of the effects of slavery, that are supposed to be conscious of how problematic it is for white frat dudes to dress up as Hawaiian hula girls for Halloween, these incidents still happen. Even among some of the most highly educated people in this country, people who have an extremely concerning amount of sway in political circles, in social circles, in the media, this kind of racism persists.
What do you think it will take, Alejandra, to work through this, to get to a what everyone agrees is a better place?
Well, I think some of the first steps have already been taken. Yale has a proud history of student activism, especially among its minority students, especially in concert with the cultural centers that we have here, and students have organized. Yesterday, the March of Resilience, which was meant to celebrate the solidarity and love of people of color on campus, and in particular minority women on campus, attracted over 1,000 students. A coalition including students from all of the cultural centers has been coming together to plan next steps. The Black Student Alliance at Yale has released a tentative set of demands which will be refined. And so student activism truly is a huge part of the next steps that will be taken, and we hope the administration will respond.
Kevin Blackstone, what do you hear there? Where are we in this process of working through America's, perpetual, it can sometimes seem, race issues, this time on campus?
Well, it's an ongoing problem in this country. I mean, for a country that was founded on racism, founded on the economic system of slavery, it remains something that's at the crux of just about everything we do in this country. And it's a tremendous weight on us continually trying to move forward. The good thing is on college campuses, and I chuckle at that idea about pathological narcissism. I mean, this is political enlightenment. This is what you want on college campuses. These are our intellectual incubators. And we are seeing young people study, think for themselves, come to their own conclusions, and to act. And so I applaud this. I was at Northwestern University. I was part of the Black Student Union there, called for members only. And it was one of the reasons I went there, because it was historically a radicalized Black Student Union. And I was there in 1980. When Black football players led by Ben Butler and Chris Hinton, who would go on to play for a very long time in the NFL, put together a list of grievances, organized as Black Athletes United for the Light, and marched on the administration and demanded that discriminatory practices by the football coaching staff and the athletic department be remedied. And fortunately for them, they had a good leader in the faculty, and Alice Palmer, who helped shepherd them through the process. And they got the change that they were seeking. A new athletic director was hired, a new football coach, Denny Green.
Kevin,
was hired.
I got one more question
first,
for Sean.
First deal.
If you'll forgive me. Sean Harper, can we have racism-free campuses, or as close as we can come to that in this country, and free, open, honest academic discourse, human discourse at the same time, Sean?
I don't think that we can have racism-free campuses, given that racism itself is woven into the cultural fabric and into the architectural history.
But isn't that our goal now? Isn't that what we're working for? I mean, isn't
sure.
So can we have that push, that sincere push, and free, open, honest academic discourse?
Sure. I would sure like for us to try. So I certainly don't mean to be a pessimist here. We absolutely should be, you know, working as hard as we can to achieve racial justice in higher education, with an understanding, though, of the historical and the even contemporary forces that might undermine that particular project. But yes, we absolutely should continue to engage in productive discourse. I agree with Kevin that that's exactly what we want on a university campus.
Well, the issue hot right now, right across the country, starting in Columbia, Missouri, and well beyond. Alejandra Padin-Dujon, sophomore at Yale, thank you very much for joining us today. Good luck with your education there, Alejandra.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Harper, University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Professor Harper.
Thank you, Tom.
And Kevin Blackstone, Washington Post, University of Maryland. Thanks as always, Kevin. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.